Basic tradecraft. A body empty of its spirit couldn't survive long, not even with the best healing.
"Wake up,"
she'd sobbed at Jetson's bedside.
"Wake up, please. I'm sorry I was afraid. I'm sorry."
When it was over, they'd honored her sister as a temple elder and companion of the Avatar, who'd laid down her life to protect the bridge between humans and spirits. Future Avatars might look at the name Jetson with awe and respect. Or they'd close the book they'd found it in and go back to their lives. Yang Chen sometimes felt like she still hadn't touched down in the physical world after being thrown into the air by her sister, that she'd been subjected to a twisted version of Guru Lahima's famous feat of weightlessness, cursed to never have a stable footing again. After she'd recovered from the ordeal of Jetson's funeral, she'd spent 2 weeks in the library's history wing to understand which of her past lives had been so averse to one side of the bridge. With the goal of what? Lambasting the dead for cowardice? And found nothing. When she was finally able to get back to the spirit world, there were no shusher. The location she'd meditated to with Jetson was neither her entry point nor a place she could find. And she walked many a maddeningly similar dream landscape in search of beastly spirits. No success. She never had the chance to definitively prove that it hadn't been her fault. That Yang Chen could stand up to the exact same creature her past life could not. The vision the phoenix heels had shown her. The view purportedly from Jetson's eyes. A double impossibility. That howling mist. Yang Chen had personally never heard of such a place, and if its secrets lay buried deeper in a musty archive or reincarnated memory, then a painful search lay ahead. Was it possible for a human being's spirit to survive onward long after the body had perished? There were stories, tales of gurus who had departed from their physical forms peacefully, but of course no first-hand testimonies. Finding the answer would require more time and strength than she could spare right now. The easiest thing would be to assume the vision was a trick. A lie. Because if it wasn't, then her sister had been trapped, still was trapped, in a place of never-ending torment. She would find Jetson if there was a Jetson to be found, she vowed. She didn't sleep the rest of the way to Port Tuguk. She was running out of route, and she still hadn't spotted the ship she was looking for. The only vessels Yang Chen had seen going the opposite way were smaller boats that would be subject to the snarls of docking long enough where she was able to make peace with letting them pass. She would likely have to reveal herself to confront the shipment, and she had to make sure she didn't waste the chance checking out lesser possibilities. Eventually, the clouds parted to reveal Port Tuguk, the southernmost Shang city. The Shimsom Islands had always been home to trading posts and temporary fairs nestled along its rivers, but the Platinum Affair had forced the locals to choose a permanent victor. Big Island's deepest harbor won, and a town was quickly raised from logs and stone. Southern Water Tribe traders avoided the trap of clearance by staying away from the newly declared city limits and using small numbers of go-betweens to handle the movement of valuable ivory, hides, and nigh-imperishable dried cod flounder. They came and left the lands around Port Tuguk as they pleased, which meant the city was neither as big as Bin Er nor as unhappy. Its Zongdu Ashuna was an Agnaka law for a constitutional that had lasted the better part of a year, and Yang Chen had decided he was unlikely to be a player in the current game. If she ran into trouble here, it would be from the agents of Chai Si and Hun She. Using the cover of a cloud, Yang Chen circled Nujian in the air at a distance from the unimaginative blocks of Port Tuguk, which were scored into the gravel coast like a baker would divide flour. Her bison's path wobbled. Nujian was weakening and needed to forage after the hard journey. She had already given him her remaining rations to keep him airborne up to this point, and she herself felt like a reed drawn through the fingers until the sides touched. She couldn't stay here in the air indefinitely to wait for a ship matching the Sunbeam's description to leave. She would approach the docks from inside the city itself, she decided. She just had to figure out an entry strategy. Port Tuguk, due to its smaller size, had a stockade wall around it. One end opened to the water, and the other bulged around a massive lumber yard containing stacks of logs as big as houses. She had few options for getting inside, none of them good. She could be spotted by moonlight as easily as the sun, caught approaching from the water just as well as land. The guard stations had excellent fields of view over the land surrounding the city. She had the urge to simply leap off Nujian's back, to catch herself with nothing but wind, like she'd done so many times on the airball court, and land in the middle of the city. It was a foolish notion, would blow her cover, but she could taste the hours, the minutes she might save, more than the food her body was crying out for. No, she reminded herself. You're so close. You're so close. Play this smart. Play this right. Despite the very act being painful, she turned Nujian around to land farther away from the city. Yang Chen crouched behind the reverse slope of a small hill, out of sight from the guard stations posted along the lumberyard end of Port Tuguk. She chopped sideways with the edge of her hand, earth bending the frozen ground loose along the breadth of the open field, but not moving it. Not yet. Dust and soil moving on its own was a sure sign of bending at work. But dust on the wind? Just the weather. Once Yang Chen had enough earth prepared, she began drawing air to her. The breeze blowing against the city turned into a gale. The dirt became flying grit. Handily, there were thick trails of wooden splinters and bark shavings outside the walls, adding to the mix of debris. Yang Chen saw the guards in their stations turn their heads away, shield their faces, pull their hoods tighter. As generous a gift as she would get. Yang Chen crested the hill and applied more wind to her back. She ran, barely touching the ground, her feet acting only as nudges to keep her stable. She crossed the distance to the wall in the blink of an eye and sped through the lumberyard gate. Yang Chen didn't stop running until she reached the cover of a massive log pile. She skidded to a halt, gouging small trenches into the ground with her heels, and checked behind her to see if she'd been made. The pair of guards above the gate rubbed their faces and swore at the sky. One of them cursed the spirits, and the other laughed. Yang Chen stared at them for a moment before pulling her hood over her head and skulking away. Port Tuguk was built out of unsanded yeso timbers still bleeding sap. Houses were double-walled with sod for insulation. The streets were paved with little splinters of bark, trampled down by countless footsteps. From the safety of a corner, Yang Chen peered into a large avenue, presumably one of the arteries that fed the international sector. The odd clerk scurried from house to house, their shoulders hunched against the wind. But there weren't as many people about as she'd expected. She needed to get to a spot where she could see the docks, and ideally rest. Eat. The technique of air-assisted speed used up so much energy. If she acknowledged that she was on the verge of collapse after her journey, she would surely teeter over the edge. Her clothes, the same heavy quilted coat and skirt she'd worn in Bin Er, blended in well enough. Keeping her chin tucked, she walked down the main street toward the water. After a minute, she snapped her fingers in the air, miming the act of forgetting something important. She glanced over her shoulder, wondering if she should go back for it, then waved the idea away and continued walking. Yang Chen turned at the next corner and pressed her back to the wall, staying in the angle of a shadow. One person strolled by, oblivious to anything but the shallot flatbread he was eating, and Yang Chen nearly lost count at one, so distracted was she by the smell. Then a second person passed, and a third. The third person, a woman carrying a bale of empty burlap sacks, noticed Yang Chen loitering for no reason and gave her a strange look. But that was of no concern. The fourth person she'd seen behind her walking in the same direction never materialized, even though there were no doors he could have plausibly gone into on her side of the street. Which meant he'd paused after losing sight of her. He was hanging back a safe distance. I've got a tail, Yang Chen thought. Based on the quick glimpse she'd had when she'd forgotten something, combined with the process of elimination, it was the short man with the patch on his parka. Normally she would have been thrilled. Tails were for people who were on the right track. Yang Chen went to the other end of the block and kept heading in the same direction along the parallel avenue. If Patch showed up again, then she could be sure he was following her. But to do so would be clumsy of him, and she expected better. There was a group on the opposite side of the street, huddled around an outdoor fire and a steaming cauldron of hot fermented rice drink. She passed the gathering as closely as she could, enough to scrape coats, which caught them by surprise. Sure enough, she immediately overheard two of the men telling their friends goodbye. In their haste, they burned their tongues on their final sips and said the names of the people they wanted to give their regards to a little too loud. So, a pair behind her, and one roaming. She'd been marked as suspicious for sure, by men who were likely in Chai Si's or Han She's pocket. But did they know who she really was? There was no plausible reason for them to guess she was the Avatar. Regardless, her plans had fallen apart. Any hope of recovery was going to require some quick surgery. She detoured again, her pattern now a zigzag no reasonable person would take. She caught sight of Patch again, in front of her this time. Well, that's just sloppy. Yang Chen stalked toward him, expecting the man to slide out of her way in the hope she hadn't made him yet. But he stood his ground. She frowned under her hood and slowed at an intersection to get her bearings. Only one of the drinks stand patrons was behind her, to the south. The other had swung around to close off the street to the west. She wasn't being tailed. She was being herded. Flee east. They wanted her to move east. They probably had a trap waiting. Flee over the rooftops. Making her escape with airbending would have been trivial. It would also tip them off that an air nomad willing to put on a disguise and sneak around their employer's secret project was here. She would have to pick one element, not air, and stick with it. Water? None at hand. Fire? It was getting darker fast, and she didn't want to draw more attention, or even worse, light up her face. It would have to be Earth. She must have given away a tell when she decided, glanced down at the ground without realizing it, because Patch did too, lowering his eyes. He was an earthbender, and now he assumed she was one as well. He would wait and listen as they approached, probably attempt to counteract any moves she made using the earth between them, while his partners attacked from the left and right. Pack tactics. A glint of metal in one of their hands, the three men closed in. The nearest house was dark, no one inside who might come if she yelled. The urge to run filled her body. Yang Chen's breath turned to mist in the dropping temperature. Maybe the reason she hadn't been able to find Shishi during her meditations into the spirit world beyond the first was because she'd crossed over with selfishness in her heart, failing at Jetson's challenge to only exist and not seek. She'd wanted to prove she was braver than her past lives, and the spirit world, knowing, had forever denied her that opportunity. The physical world, however, was content to give her plenty of chances to face her fears. She stamped hard upon the ground, letting her head drift down and to the left. The earthbender's gaze followed, thinking the attack would come from that section of the street. But the glance was a fake. Yang Chen had sought out different earth. She chambered her fists, and clumps of sod burst out of a bad seal in the log walls belonging to the house behind the three men. Patch and the fellow to his right took the soft but weighty masses of earth and grass to the backs of their heads and were out like candles. The third man, however, managed to twist at the last second, catching the sod in the ribs. He fell to his hands and knees, his knife clattering away, and looked up just in time to catch Yang Chen's hood falling off her head from an errant flying pebble. For a moment, they were both very still. Recognition dawned on the man's face, and then sheer confusion took over. If he didn't know she was the Avatar before, he certainly knew now. It occurred to Yang Chen that they were arranged like a painting, the bridge between spirits and humans receiving a prostrating supplicant. She used the man's hesitation to air spout him up, and then drive him back to the ground hard, knocking him unconscious. Yang Chen looked around at the aftermath of the victory and bit the heel of her hand. Captives. She had captives now, including one who knew she was the Avatar. Letting them go wasn't an option, but any hidden prison she could bend, underground or in the ice outside the city, would more than likely kill them. They had to be brought inside somewhere, quickly. She stared at her limp, downed foes, as if they might offer up a solution. She herself could think of only one. And she really, really didn't want to use it. While most of Port Tugak had been constructed after the Platinum Affair, it had been the site of Water Tribe trade fairs going back into the ancient past. There were a few great karmat of turf and stone in the city that had been carefully maintained over the centuries, and they remained important centers to those who knew their significance. Yang Chen knocked on the door of one such lodge. The door opened slightly ajar. Inside, flickering lamps cast warmth and light. A water tribesman in his 30s peered at her through the crack. "I'm looking for a game," she said. At this distance, it was impossible for him not to see her face and tattoos. His eyes widened, and he tried to shut the door. Yang Chen flicked her foot and earthbent a rock into the hinge, preventing him from locking her out. "I said I want a game. You're not going to humor me and get the board?"
"I'm pretty sure you're not a member," he said.
Not the answer she wanted.
"I see you favor the White Lotus Gambit. Not many still cling to the ancient ways," Yang Chen said, lowering her voice half in mimicry, half in mockery of this man who was trying to bar the garden gate to she who had eaten the fruit and tasted its mysteries.
"Those who do can always find a friend," she replied to herself normally. The man pulled on the handle with more force, to no avail. Yang Chen would continue having both sides of this conversation if need be.
"Jasmine 1-7," she said. "Rose 2-6, White Lily 3-6, Chrysanthemum 4-6, White Jade 5-6, Rhododendron 6-6, Dragon at 2-5, start with Knotweed at 5-2.
She stopped to take a breath.
"Repeat tile sequence, but mirror the placement along the 0-0-6-6 line. Repeat for the remaining three quadrants, following Knotweed with the appropriate tile in the element cycle. Welcome, sister. The White Lotus opens wide to those who know her secrets."
He stared at her, bewildered. She didn't have time for him to parse out that her identifying arrangements were indeed correct.
"Look, the deal is right there in the last part of the passphrase," she said. "You can't actually be certain that I'm not a member. The hurdle is knowing the secrets, and I know the secrets.
You are obligated to open wide. While he didn't comply with enthusiasm, he at least stuck his head out to check if Yang Chen had been followed.
What is it you really want?
She stepped back to reveal the three unconscious bodies she'd sledged here using earthbending under the cover of darkness.
Some help dealing with this.
The color drained out of the man's face.
I need to ask a higher-ranking Lotus, he said.
He pulled the door shut hard enough to snap the bottom hinge and left Yang Chen waiting in the freezing night air. Conversations. Eventually, the doorkeeper and two more men came around to drag away the tails Yang Chen had knocked out. She was led into the Karmak. The first thing she did was go over to the Kulik and sit down. Without registering any of the other details inside, and before she could stop herself, she nodded off, helpless against her fatigue. She woke up shouting a curse, unsure of where she was or whether her ship had set sail.
Relax, said a woman who was tending to the moss wicks of the oil lamp. You've only been napping for an hour. The world's not going to end before sunrise.
Easy for her to say.
The ships, Yang Chen slurred.
She slapped her cheeks with both hands until she was fully awake.
Did any ships leave port around sunset?
No vessels left after midday. No departures are scheduled tomorrow either, if that's what you're worried about.
Yang Chen had already said more than she wanted to in front of this woman who was already prying. Unanimity was still in Port Tuguk, which meant she could technically rest easy for a little while. Technically.
What happened to the men I brought?
They're being held in a secure place until you decide what to do.
The woman had grasped the air avatar's need to keep them silenced, but not harmed. She leaned closer to the firelight, letting Yang Chen take in her weathered face, her pale blue eyes.
You can call me Mama.
Yang Chen knew Mama was checking to see if the avatar recognized her, and the only reason she'd do that was if they'd crossed paths before. But Yang Chen hadn't seen this woman anywhere she could remember, at least not up close. Advantage to her host.
Thank you, Mama.
They were alone in the room. The woman beckoned at a cooking pot over the fire. A trail of soup streamed into a bowl, which she gave to Yang Chen.
Meatless, she said.
Yang Chen would certainly have been forgiven by the Western Temple in this case, but she was grateful for the accommodation anyway. She took the bowl and said nothing until she'd finished three servings. It was the first meal she'd eaten in days.
The paths of the White Lotus and the Avatar normally only intertwine during moments of generational import, Mama said. Not because someone needs to stash a few bodies. I don't know how one of your past lives got access to our recognition codes, but it was a mistake to let it happen.
How do you know it wasn't me who got access to them?
Mama fixed her with her gaze.
Because you're an amateur.
She filled a cup with tea and pushed it into Yang Chen's hands.
You're the rankest sort of amateur there is. You're too active. You do too many things yourself on the operation, and you expect results too quickly. You've no ability to wait whatsoever.
This was why she didn't ask favors from the White Lotus. For Mama to say that meant they had watched her struggle after Tianhaishi. Nothing during her travails back then suggested an organization of the world's wisest masters was secretly helping her behind the scenes. The White Lotus, like everyone else, had turned their eyes away from immense suffering and done nothing. She couldn't forgive that. Perhaps Mama was referring to her actions around unanimity, and she'd been under observation this whole time, like an insect
tricked into thinking the stick and leaf in her jar made up the entire world.
"You're not the local depot keeper," Yang Chen said. "As far as I can tell, you're too high-ranking of a lotus, and you're from the north, not the south. That means you've come all the way down to Port Tugak for an important task that couldn't be trusted to anyone else. You're investigating something, aren't you?"
Mama didn't answer.
"We could do an information trade," Yang Chen offered. "That's what you professionals do all the time, isn't it? If you think I'm such a fool, let's compare leads and see who got further to their goal."
"Stop," Mama said, looking as exasperated as any Western Temple elder. "Just stop. Stop playing around and for once think about the kind of avatar you want to be."
"You mean what kind of figurehead?" Yang Chen thought. "How should I pose for my statue? Have the people around me been sufficiently awed by my presence? How long did awe feed a person anyway? How long did it keep them warm?" Mama could see she wasn't getting through.
"You think spying and intelligence and deception is a good use of your power. Such a waste when you, more than any person in known history, could inspire people with the truth instead."
"And what do you mean by that?"
"Practically every avatar struggles to commune with their past selves," Mama said. "But you, the wealth of knowledge and wisdom at your fingertips, if you embraced your gift, walked with your predecessors along the courses of their lives to the breadth and depth you alone among the generations seem to be able to do, then there would be no limit to your accomplishments. You could guide the four nations to a new gilded era, because you were there for the old ones. How do you know about my gift?"
Yang Chen's question was sharp and swift enough for the older woman to realize she'd made a mistake. The lights grew dim. The emotions of firebenders could manifest in surrounding flames, and right now the avatar was ready to burst.
"How do you know about my gift?" Yang Chen repeated slowly.
Only the Western Temple elders fully understood her relationship with her past lives. They'd kept the secret well, just like they'd promised to each other. For a member of the White Lotus to know, that meant Yang Chen had been spied upon since childhood. Since before she'd been revealed to the world as the Avatar.
"You had someone in the Western Air Temple," she murmured. "You had someone in my home, evaluating me like an asset in my home."
"You were the most important child in the world."
Mama wouldn't look her in the eye.
"And you were unstable. It would have been irresponsible not to monitor you."
The lamplight fractured into crosses, blurred by Yang Chen's tears. The sheer hypocrisy of telling her not to be concerned with spies, to then go on and explain she'd been the target of spies since before she could remember.
"That was my home, do you understand? That was my home."
She was holding tea for some reason. She put it down and stood up. The motion made her dizzy, and her shoulder found a wall to rest on.
"That was my home,"
she said again, as if enough repetitions could force Mama to fully understand the extent of the violation. That Yang Chen wasn't talking about a place, but a time in her life. Her own life. Her childhood in the Western Temple was supposed to be the part of her that was real. The part free of manipulations and ulterior motives. And it was gone now. It had been painted with the same dirty ink as every other operation that had gone on in the history of the Four Nations. Could it have been Demola or Searing answering to the White Lotus? Was she to suspect Boma forevermore? And Jetson, If Jetson had masters outside the temple, had been feigning sisterhood with Yang Chen to get an outcome better suited to their needs, then there wasn't a Yang Chen. There was no person inside the robes.
She'd be as the Phoenix Eel said, an empty shell with no yolk inside.
She slid down the wall, the seams of her coat tearing against the rough-hewn stone.
That was my home, she said, choking on the falsehood of it all.
Yang Chen folded into the corner. Mama came over and knelt beside her.
I'm sorry, she said, with a flatness that acknowledged how useless the apology was. She turned Yang Chen so she wasn't bending her spine sideways and tucked a rolled-up quilt between her and the wall. Mama's earlier confession robbed the warmth from the gesture. She wasn't trying to provide Yang Chen comfort. She was making sure the Avatar didn't hit her head. The White Lotus's agent inside the temple had told them about the liability. The asset had to be protected.
Better not to know who it was. Better never to ask.
I already tried,
Yang Chen whispered. Her throat was scraped and raw, as if a common illness had chosen to strike her at her lowest point.
Tried what? I already tried your suggestion.
She shivered and pulled the corners of the quilt around her.
I sought out the avatars of eras gone by. At some point, I figured, why not go on the attack, you know?
The emotional storms brought on by memories of her past lives, so vivid she couldn't tell who or where or when she was, didn't preclude trying to commune the more dignified way.
I only let the elders know about a fraction of my successes, Yang Chen said. I spoke to dozens of previous avatars. Upon dozens, upon dozens.
She watched Mama frown.
You don't actually like that, do you? That I've done exactly as you've proposed? Telling Yang Chen to bury herself in history had probably seemed like wise counsel in the older woman's head, but carried out and made real. It cheapened a sacred component of avatarhood.
I saw through their eyes, watched their lives unfurl, Yang Chen said. Time doesn't pass the same way inside a vision as it does in the physical world. At first, I was overwhelmed by the noise of it all. As someone who appreciates intelligence, I'm sure you understand. The sheer quantity of information you have to sift through to find something relevant. And then, I started noticing patterns over the eras I witnessed. Repetition. I sat in front of my predecessors humbly, asked so many questions, listened to so many answers. Do you know what I learned?
Yang Chen clenched her fists around the quilt.
Their lives are full of regret, she said. Lost chances to make the world a better place. To me, that's what sticks out sharpest in their memories. Their regrets over the times they did nothing.
Why are you like this? The answer, here.
I have felt the shame of avatars gone by, she said. Lived through failures not recorded in history. And I can tell you with absolute certainty, not a single one of my past selves that I've connected with wishes they waited longer to solve a problem.
Acting only in moments of generational import. Who decided which moments were important? And how many people suffered in between? There had never been any gilded ages, as far as Yang Chen had seen.
Mama picked up an Akt Kun and went over to the Kulik to tend the wick.
A few touches of the small stick, and the flame was restored along the lip of the soapstone lamp.
"I come here from the north on a regular basis, to meet with my fellows," she said. "But this time I'm in town to investigate a possible spiritual disturbance. There have been reports of bright lights and loud noises along the tundra outside the city."
Yang Chen was so unimpressed with Mama's reason for being in Port Tuguk that it took her a while to realize her proposal for an information trade had been accepted.
"That's it?" she said. "Lights and noise?"
There wasn't much, as far as accounts of spiritual activity were concerned.
"I will admit, it's a more interesting lead now that the Avatar is here."
Mama cocked her head as if to say, "Your turn now." She obviously anticipated getting the better end of this exchange. Could Yang Chen trust the White Lotus? And more importantly, did she need their help? Three bruised men being held against their will said yes. Her exhaustion, her lack of knowledge about the area said yes. She couldn't let pride be the reason she failed. Not at this juncture. "I hope I don't regret this."
"I'm not following up on spiritual business," Yang Chen said.
She told Mama everything she knew about unanimity. Traces.
"This is news," Mama said as she tried to absorb the salient points. Yang Chen didn't think she was feigning ignorance. The White Lotus had been caught unawares by Hun She and Chai Si's secret project. While Mama could criticize Yang Chen's recklessness all she wanted, her organization was several steps behind the Avatar.
"What was the name of the ship you were looking for?"
"The Sunbeam," Yang Chen said.
"Are you sure? I didn't see any records of a Sunbeam docking here in the last 2 months."
At some point during her investigation, Mama must have stolen a glimpse of some logbooks. Yang Chen felt vindicated that her tactics had merit. But the discrepancy didn't make sense.
"My source verified the name. Three-masted junk."
Mama's response was immediate and reflexive.
"And you trust this source?"
"Yes. Yes, I do."
Yang Chen felt more energized now that the food had taken hold. She decided she'd been too dismissive of Mama's information.
"Show me the area where the spiritual disturbances were reported."
"I can do that."
Mama raised her teacup to her lips, but then lowered it before taking a sip.
"You mean now? You've barely slept."
Yang Chen threw off the blanket and got to her feet.
"The night is clear," she said. "There's enough moon, and I've told you how I feel about waiting."
Whoever Mama was, she had enough influence to walk out of Port Tuguk late at night with a guest in tow. She waved a pair of passes at the gate guards, but hadn't even bothered to let Yang Chen hold hers. When they were far enough away, Yang Chen whistled for Nu Jian. She noted Mama's ease around the giant bison. They got on and flew farther inland, over a fresh layer of sugary snow.
"There," Mama said, pointing at a large hill in the distance.
They landed on the highest point, where one side fell away sharply into a cliff. The powder reached their knees when they jumped down from Nu Jian. Yang Chen rubbed her arms as she looked around, first down the white slope of the hill, and then at the field the cliffs had atop. No tracks since the snow had fallen.
"Do you sense any spirits?" Mama asked.
Yang Chen did not. This area was simply empty. No living creature born of either world seemed to want it. She wondered what it would be like to live here by herself.
"Nothing."
She was going to be the first to give up and propose going back. But a shadow caught her eye. Or rather, several of them did.
She tilted her head and peered back at the field. "Do you see those depressions?" she asked.
"Hold on, old eyes," Mama said.
She squinted and frowned.
"You mean those very regularly spaced out depressions?"
"Like tarts on a tray." The snow far to the left and right was completely flat, but here, under the cliff, it was in the way of the landscape she really wanted to see.
"Stay behind Nujian," Yang Chen said. "The winds are about to pick up."
She took a running start and leaped off the edge of the cliff. She made sure to fall a bit before slowing her descent with airbending, twirling herself into a full lotus position. If she entered the avatar state below the top of the cliff, there'd be less danger to her only bystander. With the stars above and the snows below, Yang Chen closed her eyes and let herself become suspended, anchorless, open and vulnerable to the accumulated power of her past lives. If future avatars looked back on this moment, she hoped they wouldn't judge her, using their most incredible ability for a bit of cleaning. She swept the entire field, melting the snow, pushing it aside, riding vortices back and forth until a job that normally took a season's change was finished in a few minutes. Once the gravelly earth underneath was exposed, she touched down and let the swell of energy wash away. After her battle with old iron, she found the avatar state easier to summon. But she couldn't cling to it any more than a swimmer could grasp a wave. Yang Chen walked through the thawed field, an early springtime of her own making. The ground was spotted with craters. The largest holes were as broad as houses and half as deep, and they were all round. She took a closer look by sliding down into one of the depressions. It was about as big as a sitting room. Inside the bowl, chunks of gravel had melted and blackened. The clay underneath had been scooped out by some great force. A meteor? She thought. A meteor would have fit closely, but there were no lumps of ore nearby, no deep impact bores in the ground. And the normal signs of bending, even when fire and earth clashed, didn't mesh with her surroundings. Yang Chen heard the trails of a shout, and she turned around. Her fellow investigator waved her hands from the top of the hill, telling her to come back.
"Staying down there was a waste of time," Mama said once she'd returned. "You can read a better story from up here. Look."
From their high ground, the exposed craters made a series of perfect semicircular arcs. One close, one far, one right in the middle, dividing the distance.
"You see those glittering rocks? The ones that don't look like they belong?"
From this angle and distance, the moonlight sparkled against small piles of stones that must have contained reflective mineral. They were regularly placed, as if to make an imaginary grid, one that narrowed until reaching the hill as its focal point.
"Those are distance markers," Mama said. "Siege engineers in the Fire Nation use them to test slings, crossbows, projectile throwers. Earthbending soldiers practice on fields like this one, so they can get sorted by power and accuracy."
"But there's no war machine in the Four Nations that could have made those craters," Yang Chen said. "And they don't look like the results of any kind of bending I've ever seen."
"I can't explain everything," Mama said. "I can only tell you what I think. And right now, I think this entire place is a target range."
Last Chances. The Queen of Omashu was a ponderous five-masted junk, built for stability over speed. Kalyan had gotten Kavik on board by passing him off as one of the authorized cargo mates, a member of the crew responsible for the secure transport of an individual shipment. Kavik had trouble reconciling how an identity that could pass a harbor master's inspection could be thrown together so quickly, even by a boss-boss, until it dawned on him that Kalyan had already prepared this cover long ago. For himself. Kavik was using up his brother's means to come home. "I'm sending you back to Bin-Ur on the same ship as Unanimity," Kalyan had said. "Hun Shu's leaving earlier on a faster vessel, and will be waiting for the drop-off. He has to get it without a hitch, do you understand? I'm not safe until he does. Afterward, I want you to go home and take care of Mother and Father. If the Avatar's team snoops around, I'll leave a trail that makes it plausible you were ordered away by the Association." The lights in his eyes danced faster than ever. "The next few days could be important. And I'd prefer you were around to protect our family in case things don't go according to plan." Once the voyage had begun in earnest, Kavik nearly broke down in a laughing fit. He still didn't know what Unanimity was. Perhaps he never would. He'd remain in the dark forever, wandering unenlightened. But down below decks, it was painfully obvious that three large wooden boxes among the many, each about as tall as his head, contained the assets the Avatar had been searching for this whole time. How could he tell? The muscle sitting in front of them. Two men and one woman never left the container's sides. They took their meals by themselves and slept in shifts. They were tall and powerfully built. Based on their golden eyes, Kavik assumed all three were Fire Nation. They might have been benders since they carried no weapons, but then again, he doubted the wisdom of shooting flames inside a wooden ship. Their size alone would have carried them through plenty of fights. Kavik tried some small talk when the other crew members weren't around, volunteered to be the one who brought them food from the galley. They ate massive quantities, easily double the rations of the other crew members, but they were ferociously tight-lipped. The woman's name was Ying Su, the bearded man was Xiao Yun, and the guy with the long ears was Dapa. They did not want to play sparrow bones with Kavik as a fourth. He watched the shores of Bin-Ur approach for the second time in his life. During the first, the harbor had seemed so vast, a wide open mouth, ever feeding. But now he was coming at the continent from a different angle, a bigger ship. And from the top deck, high above the waterline, Kavik noticed signs of trouble before they got close enough to lower anchor. Several piers at the far end had burned down to their posts, blackened stumps sticking out of the water. Warehouse doors that normally would have been kept wide open during daylight hours had been chained shut. Men with clubs patrolled the docks, the actual longshoremen eyeing them warily as they passed. The Shangs must have liked Tae Yin's tactics at Gidu Shrine and hired more head kickers. "They're only catching up to Chai Si's level," he thought. The Queen of Omashu was secured to her berth by expert hands moving around Kavik, who was merely a stone in the river at this point. Hoists and winches were quickly set up to reach across the deck and pluck cargo from the hold. He shuffled out of the way, focusing his attention past the warehouses. There were standoffs occurring all the way down the avenues leading away from the docks. Groups of men and women shouting curses, chains of people with linked arms, broken wares strewn over the ground, as if goods had been ambushed and destroyed on their routes deeper into the city. "What happened while I was gone?" he started to ask himself. But then he realized his surprise was unfounded. He knew very well the wounds Bin-Ur hid under its bandages, and they'd begun to fester. A team of harbor masters boarded the boat to check clearances. This arrival had to be as clean as the dishes on the Earth King's table. Kavik's cover, or rather Kalyan's, worked flawlessly, and the inspectors paid him little mind. He spotted Zongdu Hunshu waiting by the unloading area for his prize. Kavik had seen him at public events around Bin Er. The word on the street was that Hun Shu was basically the Shang's lapdog. But did it matter how fearsome his reputation was when he effectively held Kao Yan hostage? Kavik gritted his teeth and kept out of Hun Shu's line of sight. The three huge guards, wrapped in bulky coats, walked down the gangplank so they could watch the assets touch down on dry land. They made a cordon around the unloading area by virtue of existing. Hun Shu pressed closer, but didn't address them. The elevated framework connecting the ship to the dock was completed. The first unanimity crate rose from the hold, needing the strength of several men pulling on the hoist ropes, wooden spars groaning as the box levitated underneath them, crossing from ship to shore. Kavik held his breath as the assets made their descent. The final stage of the journey. And then, a small flame shot over his head. Less than a candle's worth. If he didn't know better, he would have believed it came from Ying Su's fingers, while everyone was looking elsewhere. He turned around to see a scorched, glowing wound eating deeper into the line. The hoist juddered with each skein that gave way. "Get back!" he and several people cried out at once. There was enough warning to clear the immediate area, but not to save the cargo. The rope snapped, and unanimity fell crashing to the ground. When the dust cleared, Kavik poked his head over the rail. The Shang men were in motion, screaming and shoving at the frightened dock workers, demanding to know where the fire had come from. The crate was destroyed, its contents piled on the docks. Kavik stared in shock at the great secret, exposed for all to see. Unanimity was a pile of stones. Chop seal blanks, to be precise. That couldn't... How... Kavik searched for Hun Shu in the crowd. The Zongdu of Bin Er was already walking away with the three shipment guards in tow, using the distraction to avoid any further notice from the harbor masters. They rounded the corner of a warehouse and disappeared. "You were so close with the logbook," was what Kao Yan had said. "Shipments have to be escorted by specific crew members during the voyage, named in advance," was what the Avatar had said. Hun Shu hadn't cared about the physical goods. He'd only wanted a particular delivery to occur, because he needed the people who had been cleared to travel with it from Zhangdu to Bin Er. They were the assets. They were unanimity. Kavik shouted, incoherent, no plan in his head to form words. His voice was lost in the din. He ran down the gangplank and ducked through scuffles escalating into brawls until he reached a point where he'd lost sight of Hun Shu and the other three. But he was too late. They were gone. Clarity. In Bin Er, the vortex was spinning. The crushing ice closed in, threatening to smash, skewer anything caught inside. The fracas at the docks was only the edge of the whirlpool. Kavik headed deeper into Bin Er to find that the residents had gone from crowding the square to blocking the streets with barricades, some earth-bent or frozen into place, others simply construction debris heaped up high. He learned that night skirmishes had been fought to maintain them against the Shang brutes seeking to unclog the flow of traffic and force people back to work. A few arteries through the city remained open to official business, but everyone expected Earth King Fei Shan to step in soon. There were reports of troops marching toward Bin Er. Comeuppance for the Shangs was at hand, claimed some gleefully. Others shook their heads in fear at the prospect of an intervention. Who would the Earth King side with? Did he even understand there were sides? Or would he simply level the city and start anew? It was dangerous to cross town, he was warned over and over again by shop owners through the cracks in the boards they'd nailed over their windows, by mothers pulling their children back through their doors, by the men and women manning the barricades against the head kickers. Each time he gave his thanks and continued on his way over their concerns. Someone had told him once that he had good moves. He could wriggle his way through the dangers. As far as Kavik was concerned, he'd done what his brother had asked. The Avatar had been sent off to Port Tuguk, oblivious to his betrayal, and she'd missed the crucial shipment. Hun Shu had gotten his due and had no further reason to threaten Kalyan. What was so special about those people that they were worth so much trouble? At least one of them was a firebender. Likely all three were. Kavik's stomach contracted around a stone of uneasiness. He needed to warn the Avatar of their terrible mistake, that the assets in question were human beings. Unanimity had slipped past them and was in Bin Ur under Hun Shu's control. Kalyan had told him he could play both sides. All was not yet lost. He had to find a messenger hawk. Fast.
"It's not your fault,"
Boma said in the back room of the small inn he was staying at. Yang Chen had introduced Kavik to her grouchy old advisor before they departed from Bin Ur, over a cup of tea that was less a proper introduction, and more a chance to memorize each other's faces. Boma's frown hadn't changed, was still the same flat line chiseled into his block of stone expression. But his gaze was kind and warm. He'd been surprised to see Kavik come back without the Avatar, but the partial truth sufficed. Kavik had been forced to accompany the unanimity shipment by the association, and now they needed to make the best of a bad scenario. Boma believed the Avatar's runner had done a good job under the circumstances. And why wouldn't he? Kavik withheld the facts about his brother and his betrayal. He couldn't risk Boma shutting him down, refusing to believe him. A confession might have made the old man react by apprehending Kavik and sitting tight until further notice from Yang Chen. Precious time would be lost. He blinked away tears. Boma must have thought he was overcome with guilt for not being able to stop the shipment. "We have to contact the Avatar and tell her to come back to Bin Ur as fast as she can," Kavik said. "She might still be chasing the wrong leads in Port Tuguk."
"I'll get a hawk to send to Port Tuguk immediately," Boma said. "But what if she's already left? If she went back to Jeondudi, we won't be able to get word to her by aerial message. It's why I couldn't tell any of you how bad the situation in Bin Ur was. She could be stuck on the island, waiting for an update that'll never come."
Kavik had an answer for that, just not a good one. "She won't linger in Jeondudi. If she goes back there, she'll come straight here after, without delay. I guarantee it." Boma looked uncertain. "Trust me," Kavik said. "A bird to Port Tuguk is what we need to cover our options." The old man nodded and got up. He retrieved a small tube and a miniature scroll from a satchel, along with ink and a fine brush.
"I'll leave you to it while I go arrange for the hawk," he said, handing Kavik the supplies. "Right, small."
Boma didn't even check the message Kavik had written before sending the hawk. "Trust me." He'd kept making the demand, and it kept working. Kavik stayed at the inn over the next few days, unable to go home and face his parents. Boma did him another kindness and checked up on them. They were okay for now. Safe. Still laboring under the impression that their youngest son was training with the Avatar. During his time there, he slept fitfully through daylight hours, leaving only to scout the city for unanimity. He was trying to rid himself of the conclusion that he'd done everything he could. Waiting made him feel helpless. Hadn't that been the origin of his troubles? the source of every decision he'd made. He'd come back to the one place he didn't want to be. And now he was waiting for the Avatar. Waiting for the city's time to run out. Waiting for something to shatter. When he couldn't take it anymore one night, he tried to reach the last remaining presence in Bin-Ur who could have granted him some stability. The person who was bedrock, who had certainly weathered great troubles in decades past. He went to visit Mama Ayunarak. Only to be told at her door that she wasn't there. She'd left the city. In a daze, Kavik stumbled around her building to the trash pile where he kept the loose brick with his house key. His feet had carried him out of habit. He began to cry, haltingly and without tears, as if part of him still had to be uncommitted, even in his deepest despair. He whispered a hoarse request to the air above for any kind of relief. He must have been heard by the spirits, and the skies had judged him harshly, because they answered with a blooming ball of flame and a thunderclap that knocked him to his hands and knees. A whine in his ears, scorching air licked the back of his neck. He looked up, and a halo of smoke drifted away, its source nowhere to be found. While the streets weren't as crowded as they used to be, there were still some people about, and they were all as confused and frightened and deafened as Kavik. Slowly, he and the other folks who had been flattened by the sudden burst of heat and force got up, trying to understand what had happened. Through the ringing in his skull, Kavik heard a faint pop-pop sound, the bouncing strike of fingers against a tightened drum. And then, another burst erupted further down the block. He saw it fully this time, an expansion of light with the suddenness of a noisemaker. But instead of a cloud of colorful pinpricks, it was a solid sphere of angry pressure, a ball of fire in the sky. Dust and debris rippled outward along the street, and he shielded his eyes before he was blown backward by a wave of air as powerful as any he'd seen the Avatar produce. When he blinked away the grit, there was again no trace of the power that had forced everyone to the ground. Around him, mouths opened in screams. People crawled away in terror, scrambled to their feet, broke out into a panicked stampede. "Nothing bad will happen if the Avatar doesn't get her way." Kavik still couldn't hear the cries of the people running through the street, but he could hear Kalyan's voice telling him before he left Janduri not to worry, that everything would be fine. Unanimity wasn't so bad. It would stabilize the situation in Bin-Ur. There was a third crack above the rooftops, distant enough that Kavik only suffered the report and not the blast directly. The damage was getting systematically spread over the city. "Don't worry about it," had always been Kalyan's refrain. It had been the case in Bin-Ur when Kavik confronted him about why he wasn't coming home much. And then again, further back in the past, when they were stuck in that fearsome blizzard, Kavik thinking for certain the two of them were going to die. How many times had he heard it during their march through the blinding white, the stinging snow? The storm that plugged their tracks so quickly that Kavik couldn't be sure if they'd already perished, had left their bodies and were merely floating atop the drifts. "We'll be fine. I'm your brother. I would never let anything bad happen." As good a liar as Kavik was, he would only ever be second best in his family. His family. He had to reach his parents. He got up and ran around the back of Ayunarak's toward the Water Tribe quarter. People were scrambling to get inside, abandoning their positions at barricades, fleeing the streets. He raced alongside a group heading in the same direction, his lungs burning. Some of them he recognized from Nuhingak's. Another explosion at their right broke their stride. The members of his little pack skidded on their heels, slipped, fell. Some had already begun to kneel where they were to beseech the spirits for mercy, too scared to take another step forward. Kavik turned his eyes away. He'd put his faith in the wrong party, too. He left them and kept running until he reached the Water Tribe quarter, his house, and slammed his key repeatedly into the door, all misses from his shaking hands, until he finally got it right, one small thing right, and unlocked it. Inside, his parents huddled as far as they could from the walls, while dust rained around them each time a fresh explosion struck. Their silent relief when they saw his face was too much to bear. Kavik knelt down, threw his arms around his terrified mother and father, and hugged them harder than he ever had in his life.
"Kavik, where is the Avatar?"
his mother asked through her tears.
"Why isn't she here? Why isn't she with you?"
The one person who could have stood up to the nightmare in the sky, who saw the Shangs and the Zhongdus and unanimity for the brewing disasters they were, who had been right about everything the whole time, except for her choice in friends, was somewhere far away across the sea. And that was Kavik's doing.
"She'll be here soon,"
he said, rocking his parents in his arms, a mirror of the comfort they had given him as a child.
"She'll fix this.
Have faith." They stayed in their house as much as possible. A peek through the windows at the empty lanes of the Water Tribe quarter told them their neighbors had fled indoors too. The city was completely dark at night. No one put up visible lights in their homes, out of fear they'd draw the attention of the angry spirits above. Nor could anyone sleep through the noise, which sometimes arrived in walking barrages that crept closer and lower, descending, stalking, until Kavik was certain the final strikes would come crashing through his roof. Within a short span, it seemed like the whole of Bin Ur had been beaten into submission. The residents of the city were being punished by forces beyond their comprehension. Hunsha had secured his version of stability. Kavik wasn't sure how firebenders in his employ could be so powerful, what kind of technique allowed them to create explosions from afar. But he was certain that Zhongdu could no longer be challenged as long as he retained control over unanimity. Dazed by a lack of sleep, he lost track of how long it had been since he'd returned to Bin Ur. When the knock came at his door, he jumped, fearing any sound that resembled the faint tapping that could sometimes be heard before the greater concussions. He kept his parents away from the entrance. Before opening the door, he pressed himself against the wall with water in hand. Gingerly, he unlatched it and peeked through the crack. Once he saw who it was, Kavik let the door swing fully open and stood face to face with his visitor. Jujinta stared at him for a good long minute. He leaned to the side to look past Kavik's shoulder at his bewildered parents crouched in the corner behind the desk. He took in as much of the house as he could see from the threshold before finally returning his attention to Kavik. With great care, Jujinta reached into his collar and pulled out the bison whistle Kavik had given to him before leaving Jeonduri, along with instructions to use it whenever he meditated alone or made offerings to the spirits at shrines by himself. "You are right," he said, placing it back into Kavik's hands. "The answer came to me." He was a changed man. Before, whenever they'd spoken, Jujinta's eyes had always been slightly vacant and dull, as if part of him were trapped in another place and time. But now, he was fully present. He shone with inner purpose. Meeting the Avatar face to face could do that to a person. The fact that he was at Kavik's door with the whistle said the rest. The message to Yang Chen had been successfully passed on. The Avatar was in Bin Ur. "Come on," Jujinta said, never one to waste words. Everyone's waiting for you. The display. Hun Sha, who was arguably the most powerful man on the continent right now, had been reduced to a glorified porter. The three firebenders, he had no other label for them that fit, ate voraciously, and they were leaving their stations too frequently for food. Given that he was the only person in the city he trusted with the secret of their existence, he went and fetched their meals himself. He tromped up the stairs of the empty, dingy lodge to the second floor, carrying trays of buns and dumplings, instantly gone cold in the chill air, and nudged himself through a door with his foot. Long-eared Tapa maintained his vigil at the window. Since he had the most raw power of the three, his task was to keep the encroaching forces of the Earth King at bay, and his hiding place overlooked the outskirts of the city. The other benders, Ying Su and Xiao Yun, were posted in separate apartments deeper in, with good views of Bin Er's major districts. Hun She had selected their locations well in advance and covered his tracks just in case. He was about to ask for a status update when Tapa put up his hand.
Hold on, the firebender said, craning his neck. Movement.
He stepped back from the window to perform his technique. Hun She put the food down to watch. It was fascinating every time. Tapa began a series of inhalations, each one bigger than the last, until his chest ballooned in and out. When he got to about 20 or 30 massive breaths taken, his eyes widened, and he threw his head forward. His gut caved into his body, and a rush of air lifted the debris in the room. There was a pop-pop, and a rhythmic double drum beat. And then, the roar. Far downfield over the snowy plain, a seed of fire flowered into a spherical inferno, boiling snow and hurling soil, sending ripples through the air. Fireworks were an obvious but poor comparison. Hun She had once seen a grain silo explode in the middle ring, and that kind of damage was more apt. Tapa's little warning shot could have taken out a small city block.
Movement stopped, Tapa said.
He rubbed his forehead in a strange way after the act, using the fingers of both hands to press into the skin above his eyebrows and stretch it apart. It was as if he needed to widen an imaginary hole in his head to relieve the pressure. Such destruction at such range. There was no other bending like it in the world. The Earth Kingdom Scout Brigade amassed at the opposite end of the plain shrank farther back into the tree line, where Tapa had kept them penned. They wouldn't be marching upon Bin Er anytime soon. Tapa himself had cleverly suggested that he blow apart the ground on occasion to make earthbenders considering a tunnel into the city fearful of cave-ins. The other two firebenders, who were more precise, had a different mission. Their role was to cow the populace by aiming explosions over the city itself. They'd complied beautifully, stunning unruly crowds, forcing them back indoors. He'd allowed them to aim at empty barricades, blast craters in the streets, even take out the top floor of the Gidu Shrine, which he always found ugly, a mar upon the skyline. Whole sections of town, strongholds of the agitators, had been made to suffer, slammed repeatedly by violent bursts above them throughout the night. But the benders who comprised unanimity weren't to kill anyone. Hun She didn't want to destroy Bin Er or its residents. At some point, he needed business to resume, or else he'd never get his money. Tapa took a break to eat. He consumed the food joylessly, washing down half-chewed mouthfuls with water so he could finish faster. If there was a downside at all to his technique, it was the energy it drained from him, and the time it took to gather enough strength for the next explosion. Hunsha shuddered to think of a bender who didn't have such weaknesses.
"How did you come by this power?" he asked.
Hunsha knew what to expect from unanimity, how to deploy the assets properly, but nothing about their origins. Chai Si was the last person in the world who would volunteer such information. Thapa glanced up from his meal.
"Bitter work," he said,
as if taking offense to the words, "come by."
"Torturous training. I didn't find this ability like a coin in the street, and neither did the others. We three are the product of significant investment."
Hunsha found it odd that the firebender could talk about himself so, especially given how little he'd spoken until now.
"You look disappointed," Thapa said.
"Did you want me to say it was chance? A spiritual blessing? Because it was neither. I took a big gamble on myself to get to this point."
He paused in contemplation before taking his next bite.
"I mean, a lot of us who tried to develop this technique drowned."
"Wait, what? Drowned?" Thapa smirked as he chewed, taking his time now, as if speaking with his mouth full would be the rudest thing he could possibly do today.
"I don't think I benefit from telling you more," he said. "Let's talk about something else. Like the money you're going to pay me."
"We already discussed your compensation." And it had been painful enough. The most crucial part of getting the assets to Bin-Ur was Hunsha's promise to pay each of the firebenders an outrageous sum. His debts had birthed children, an entire clan of their own. He was going to need to profit more than all of his predecessors combined to have a chance of coming out ahead.
"I can do it," he'd reassured himself.
Only he had the full measure of what was happening in Bin-Ur. The Shangs were holed up in their manors, heard the noise, saw the lights, but they still didn't know the details of unanimity. He alone held all the information.
"The situation's changed since we last bargained," Thapa said, puncturing his thoughts. "I can still tell what's happening in the city from this room. I certainly can tell what's going on with the Earth Kingdom troops I've been aiming at. And you, my friend, are in way over your head. You're hanging on by your fingernails."
Hunsha didn't like how he was being talked to. He wiped the sudden perspiration from his brow.
"We have a deal," he said,
his voice coming out shakier than it should have.
"We had a deal. Let me guess what you were originally trying to do here. Once you had me and the other two in your possession, you were going to work out an arrangement with the Shangs and the Earth Kingdom both, where you claimed a good chunk of the wealth in Bin-Ur for yourself. You'd keep us a secret, and if anyone crossed you, bang!"
Thapa reached for another bun.
"But for you to have a credible enough position, you'd need to show the people who you are bargaining with your power," he said. "The way you've had us blasting away, without end, it's all been one big demonstration, hasn't it? You can't threaten someone with a weapon they don't understand the effects of."
"Congratulations," Hunsha snapped. "You know the basics of negotiation."
"Yes," Thapa said, grinning widely. "Which means I understand your position is worse now, not better. You've demonstrated that Ying Su, Xiao Yun, and I are the only force keeping the army of the Earth King camped outside the city from marching in here to discover your part in the whole enterprise. You've demonstrated to us that we control whether Bin-Ur is open for business, not you or the Shangs. Our value has taken a leap skyward, don't you think?"
He tore into the soft bread.
I talked it over with the others before we started this little venture with you, in case we spotted an opportunity. Given what the Earth King would do to you if he knew the whole story, I think paying us our original price 20-fold is good.
Hunsha staggered back a step. 20? His foot hit a chair.
You want 20 times what we agreed upon?
Dark red bean paste spilled from the bun like entrails. Dapa shrugged.
To start.
More sweat prickled down Hunsha's neck and back. Blood rose to his face. He felt a pounding in his ears from within. He couldn't bear that cost, not even in his most optimistic plans. And it wouldn't stop at 20. Once the firebenders realized how desperate he was, it would go to 50, 100-fold. He was lost. Out of every direction his defeat could have come from, it was his own assets. His leverage turning against him. Thapa finally finished his food.
I bet you thought you held all the tiles,
he said.
Funny thing about that. Once you play your tiles, you no longer hold them.
Hunsha thought he might explode himself. He imagined his innards covering the floor. Where had it all gone wrong? What law had been written into the cosmos that declared he should fail, where people just like him had received successes and riches out of their wildest dreams? Huh, he said, the sound of his complete shattering. Huh. He looked around the room. Behind him, there was a window that faced the interior of the city. He could think of only one thing large enough to break, to hurl, to smash.
Agreed, he said to Thapa.
20 times. You'll get your money. But I realize we've overlooked one thing.
Oh?
We haven't demonstrated how far we're willing to go. Hunsha blinked slowly, calmly. You were right. For the plan to work, I'd have to admit to some degree the explosions were happening under my direction. But so far, I've told you not to kill anyone. What good a threat is that?
An outsized shriek for an outsized loss.
This city had ruined him. He'd make a mark on it in return. Without some bodies to count, people will think this was all just a warning from some angry spirits, Hunsha said. Let's draw some blood.
Thapa's interest was piqued. Now you're talking like a proper man on the brink. What should we take out?
Whatever you feel like, whomever, leave a toll. Thapa crossed over to the window facing the rest of Bin-Ur and gazed into the distance.
Can't see much from here, except for a lot of water tribe homes. A couple of wooden houses next to them. I'll start with those.
Hunsha made a grunt of indifference. The firebender started breathing in, breathing out, forcing the air in his chest to comply with his will. 5, Hunsha found himself counting with a strange sort of giddiness. 10, 20. Thapa hit 30 breaths. This blast was going to be huge. There would barely be a water tribe quarter left. 40.
40?
What's wrong? Hunsha asked, confused. What are you holding back for?
I'm not.
The firebender was sweating as badly as Hunsha had been a few moments ago. The technique was taxing, certainly, but it wasn't supposed to fail before the blast.
It's like I can't get enough air, Thapa muttered. I don't know what's happening.
He backed away from the window, completely abandoning his build-up. He clutched at his throat.
Han Sha opened his mouth to comment, but as soon as he did, his ears were stricken by a bout of uneven pressure. He jawed up and down, trying to relieve the swell. Thapa was saying something to him, but he couldn't hear clearly. Dizziness. His head spun. Edges of darkness crept around his vision. What in the name of the spirits was going on? It wasn't just him. Thapa's eyes were rolling back into his head, and his face had turned blue. Han Sha attempted to slump into the chair, landed short, his hips sliding off while he clung to the back for dear life. His breath was gone. His lungs had no strength to open. He fought for consciousness and succeeded long enough to watch Thapa keel over. He felt more than heard the smack of the large man hitting the floor. Someone else must have detected it too, been waiting for it, because the moment after the firebender collapsed, feet tromped up the stairs and into the room. With them came air, sweeter than he could have believed. His ears popped, and he could hear again. But he was too weak to do anything but hold on to the furniture, as if he'd drown without it. He looked up to see two water tribe men, one with a water skin at the ready, a bender, and the other a giant, even bigger than Thapa. While the waterbender checked the corners of the room for hidden dangers, the huge man hefted Thapa over his shoulder and carried him away with one arm. He had only the one. A young woman wearing a heavy cloak walked in. She crouched down and threw her hood back to reveal an orange collar, a blue arrow, and a familiar face. "Zongdu Han Sha," said the avatar. "You've been busy since we last spoke." Han Sha finally gave up his death grip on the chair. It slid away with a wooden screech. He collapsed and rolled over onto his back. "How did you know I was... how did any of this..." He summoned enough strength to hammer the back of his skull against the floor repeatedly. He wished he had the capacity to shout instead of wheezing impotently. "How? How?" The avatar slid one hand under his head to protect him. "Trade secrets." "What did you do to us?" Han Sha asked, grasping for anything to make sense of it all. "We just collapsed where we stood. Was that you? Is Thapa dead?" She made a hush gesture with her free hand and beckoned the waterbender over to grab him under the arms. "Unfortunately, I don't have time to chat," she said as Han Sha was dragged away. "You're not the last stop on my list today."